This is Radio Influence.
He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he scores the top.
Wow.
And here comes a mention. And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich
one
Franklin
punch
retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
History will be made on Saturday night inside the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York, as the inaugural UFC Women's Featherweight Champion will be crowned, as former UFC Women's Bantamweight Champion Holly Holm will become the fourth fighter in UFC history to win a championship in two weight classes, as she will face Germaine de Romandeme. Along with the main event title fight, the rest of the main card on pay-per-view will see former UFC Middleweight Champion Anderson Silva looking to snap a five-fight winless streak against Derek Brunson. Ronaldo Jacare Souza will look to make his case for a UFC middleweight title fight as he meets Tim Boach. Let's get back on track when he meets Jared Cannonier, and Jim Miller meets Dustin Poirier. Daniel Galvan and I are going to preview this fight card on this episode of the MMA Report Preview Podcast on Radio Influence. We will give you our picks for all of the fights, give you some prop bets we like on this card, and tell you which fight we are interested in the most. Now, before I bring Daniel in, I want to tell you about our sponsor, Fight TV. Fight is your number one source for MMA, boxing, and pro wrestling video. Get a front row seat to live wrestling, MMA, and boxing action anytime, any place. Get Fight free and see what's streaming now for you. Download the Fight app free today by going to Fight, FITE.TV /radioinfluence/. Once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV/radioinfluence/. Daniel, UFC 208, we're about 36 hours away or so from this fight card beginning. And I feel that if the main event was Holly Holm versus Chris Cyborg, I have a feeling that I think people would be more enthusiastic for this fight card than they currently are.
Oh, the difference in enthusiasm would be so stark, because this is unequivocally one of the worst main events we've had on pay-per-view for quite a while in terms of marketability, and also maybe in terms of quality too, just given where these fighters stacked up in the previous division. Yeah, Jason, simply put, Germaine de Randomie is not a marquee fighter, and I think Holly Holm, in order to be a headliner, needs a quote-unquote marquee fighter to build her stock up. I think you can get away with Holm versus Rousey, Holm versus Tate, Holm versus Cyborg, Holm versus Nunez, but not much else in the bantamweight or now featherweight division. So, yeah, this is a lackluster main event, largely because all those people that the UFC is trying to kind of bring in likely do not remember or have not seen Germaine de Randamie fight before.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things when I think about Holly Holm, and you know, last time we saw Holly Holm get a win was when she knocked out Ronda Rousey back at UFC 193, and you know, I think the UFC kind of is going a little all in on Holly Holm here, believing that she is a bigger star than what maybe people's perceptions are. I mean, I think in terms of Holly Holm's marketability, it's really unknown. Is she a fighter that has the potential to bring a unique audience to the television set, specifically when she fights on pay-per-view? When you look at her pay-per-view fights, notable pay-per-view fights, one was against Ronda Rousey, and the other one was in a co-main event of a Conor McGregor card. So it's really tough to sit back and say whether she is a draw or not. But, you know, stylistically, it should be a fun fight to watch. But I tell you, as I think about how this fight is going to play out, I think what the perception of this fight is going to be and what it ends up being in reality, I think are going to be two different things, because I think that this is a fight that we're going to see Germaine de Romandeme, for the most part, make this a clinch fight. I do not think she's going to fight range for the most part. I think she tries to take this fight against the fence, use the clinch, and ultimately I think this is going to go all 25 minutes, and I think Germaine de Romandeme is going to walk out of the cage on Saturday night as the first ever UFC Women's Featherweight Champion.
Yeah, and you aren't the only one. You know, when you look at bestfightodds.com, it is kind of crazy to see Germaine de Randamie a favorite in this fight. Obviously not a heavy favorite. It's minus 135, Holmes plus 115. But when this fight was originally booked, my initial thought, Jason, was I'm going to be really cool and I'm going to predict that Deranime wins because, like, in a striker matchup, I think she's going to win. And now everybody's doing it. So my response is to always zag when people zig. It's called the Phil Jackson philosophy. Oh, you're shooting three-pointers? Well, we're going to continue to do the triangle offense with Kylo Quinn, and we're going to kick Charles Oakley out of an arena. Anyways, the issue I have with going with Deranime in this fight is largely due to the level of competition she's faced. Now, her most impressive win, I would probably say, is over Larissa Pacheco in her second UFC victory. But Holly Holm, I would say, is going to be incredibly tough. I mean, you look at Deranime's losses to Nunez in the UFC. That certainly is the elite tier in the division when Deranime has faced. Now, what I worry about for Holly Holm, Jason, is total mental game. I think she can really get stuck in her own head based on the losses, and that can cause her to overthink this fight, and that's where I think she can lose it. But as long as there's space in the striking game, as long as she's able to disengage and really pick her shots and really feel comfortable counter-striking and potentially look to land the kick, the head kick, that's when you got to feel good about Holly Holm. Now, if the fight plays out like you said, where Jermaine is able to close that distance, able to really make Holm uncomfortable, putting her back against the cage, landing strikes within the clinch, those are rounds that are going to go her way. But for the most part, I feel real confident about Holly Holm's ability to rebound after a couple of losses here. I really like her pedigree, and I still do worry that we could see just a dramatic slump here because the quote-unquote – when you do talk about quote-unquote crossroads fights, Jason, this is a crossroads main event for Holly Holm. The difference for her winning and losing is so dramatic because with the win, she is a quote-unquote champion. With the loss, you're looking at three losses in a row, and we begin to have serious, serious questions about her long-term viability in either division.
Yeah, no question. And going back to a point you mentioned about Jermaine Deranime in terms of her UFC victories, you know, we're against Julie Kedzie, Larissa Pacheco, and Anna Elmus. They have a combined UFC record of 0-6.
So that's not particularly great. That really isn't. But there's a big divide, I think, in these divisions where you don't have much of a middle ground. You have either the fighters that piece together wins or the fighters that serve as, as just losses, nonstop losses. But I will say of those three fighters, Larissa Pacheco's put together a real nice resume prior to the UFC. And with Julie Kedzie, I mean, that was kind of Kedzie towards the end of her career. With Anna Elmus, she still has a decent amount of time. So certainly a win over Holly Holm would unequivocally be the most impressive win for Jermaine. It's just a matter of, is she going to learn the lesson that Valentina Shevchenko kind of laid out there, which is if you don't enable Holm's counterstriking, if you are more patient, you can really frustrate her. I would expect that to be so. I really would. When you watch the UFC embedded, like the camp appears to feel like they have a confident game plan, and I'm sure everyone does. I do find it curious what the adjustment will be because I'm sure there will be some type of adjustment in the fight. But picking Jermaine is a smart pick. I mean, there's a reason why she's a favorite. It's largely due to the fact that she has one big glaring weakness: her ability on the ground. And Holly Holm does not appear to be one that wants to take advantage of that.
I was listening to or watching Inside the Octagon with Dan Hardy and John Gooden as they were breaking down this fight, and I thought Dan Hardy brought up a really good point. You know, we both know, you know, these are both accomplished strikers. You know, Jermaine coming from, you know, Muay Thai, and Holly coming from boxing. But, you know, who's going to go to that backup plan if all of a sudden the striking's not going their way and shoot for that takedown? I mean, you know, I think it could happen at some point. I think Holly probably would be more likely to go for that takedown than Jermaine would be. But also, and something that was spotted in the countdown show, is this is now the second time that Mike Winklejohn has had to prepare to have one of his fighters take on Jermaine. Previously, it was Julie Kedzie, who had trained out of Jackson Wink before she retired. So that's a little bit of advantage going in here. And, you know, heading into this fight, one of the things you always, when you think of Holly, you think of, you know, one of the bigger 135ers that were in the UFC. But Jermaine does have, you know, she's 1 inch taller than her, has a 2 inch reach advantage. But what's interesting, you know, as we're recording this podcast, the weigh-ins are currently going on. It was interesting to me, and I don't know if maybe Jermaine, you know, mistimed her cut. Maybe she didn't have to really cut any weight. But she weighed in at 143 pounds, where Holly was at 144 pounds. So, you know, something to kind of pay attention there. But, you know, last week on the preview podcast, one of the questions we got was about prop bets. And so, you know, this is something that we definitely want to do kind of going forward. And I tell you, as I look at the prop bets on the main event, you know, you could go, you can go, if you want maybe more of a safe route, you can go Jermaine DeRamonde made by decision, which is a plus 255. But man, if you want to live bold, you want to make some money, Jermaine DeRamonde by majority or split decision, plus 645. My prediction is Jermaine DeRamonde is going to win this fight via split decision.
So your advice is for someone to go with a split decision prop bet.
Yeah.
I disagree with that wholeheartedly, Jason.
Look, I think the reason I say split decision, I think that a lot of these rounds are going to be close because it's going to play out on the feet, and depending on where that judge is sitting, they may see it a different than one of the other judges. So I think we're going to see, you know, 248-47s for Jermaine and 148-47 for Holly Holm.
If you nail this one, I'm going to have to buy you a steak because it is downright impossible, I think, personally, to predict split decisions other than when you know there are certain fighters where they just magically get them, but man, to nail that split decision, majority decision, if you do that prop bet, plus 640 is delicious odds. You should go and buy a lottery ticket because it's so random sometimes. But
I think when you look at the changes to the unified rules, and my understanding is New York is one of those states that is adopting these changes. You know, there's obviously a more emphasis on 10-8 round, and I think in 2017 we are going to see a lot more split decisions.
Yeah, I do think when the fight plays out in one's head, given what you've seen out of both these fighters, you should anticipate really closely contested stand-up rounds, and that's where you do see a degree of difference in the three judges, and that's when you do see the split decision, majority decision. I'm almost upset the odds aren't a little higher on that, but man, plus 640, that is a nice one to, like, show your friends the receipt you have of, oh, I knew this was going, not only the distance, but two or three judges were going to have a different opinion than the other one. I like that, actually. I wouldn't go with that. I like sticking with the safer bets, like for Holm and DeRamonde. Oh, I like this one. Ready, Jason? Are you ready for this
one? I'm ready.
This one is going to rock your world. So, fight is not a draw. I like this one at minus 13,500. Fight is not a draw. Minus 13,500. You put a dollar down. You put $13,000 down, you get a dollar back. How's that sound?
Yeah. Not definitely not the route you want to go there. I think if this fight does end via stoppage, I would probably favor Holly.
Oh, because of the head kick, right?
Yeah.
That's got to be it. Although I could see this one ending stoppage early either way, just from the power both fighters exhibit. But it is one of those things where once you get towards the second half of that second frame, you feel much more confident about this one going the distance. It's just a matter of, is there a big gap in stand-up that we weren't aware of? Because obviously with Jermaine, throughout her career, you mentioned the Julie Kedzie fight. I mean, that was three fights ago, and that was in 2013. So she has had a lot of time in between her fights, a lot of time to change up her game and whatnot. So right away, we're going to have to figure out if there is a gap in striking talent. And once that gap is showcased, then we can feel comfortable about it going the distance. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see an early knockout from either fighter. But if you're asking me which one is most likely, it would have to be Holly Holm, just because she's shown a history of capitalizing with space But with that being said, I mean, with Jermaine, she is piecing together two consecutive finishes in her UFC run here in 2015 and in 2016. And I do wonder what the experience will be like for Winklejohn having prepped Kedzie. I mean, that's one of those things where you have to take notes every time you prep a fighter because there's no way he'd be able to remember what he thought in 2013 unless he wrote it down. But the game plan may be incredibly similar because I don't know from a stylistic matchup how different Jermaine is. Obviously, her technique has changed, but how different her style is from 2013, I don't think it is very much.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, crazy stats. How about this one? Holly Holm has landed 98.8% of her significant strikes in UFC competition from a standing position. Her three significant ground strikes all came at UFC 193 against Ronda Rousey, and she becomes a fourth fighter in UFC history to get a title shot after getting two straight losses in the UFC. Any idea who the other three are?
Randy Couture one of them?
Yes, he is.
Randy Couture is one of them, and then I will go with...
You got definitely, you know, one guy was the other one. You know, one guy is back in the day, and another guy it was within the past couple of years.
So I have two more to get here.
Yeah, two more to get. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, geez. Okay. So back in the day, I'm gonna have to go with God. I don't feel good about it. BJ Penn.
No. Tank Abbott.
Damn it. And then in terms of the one that just happened, Dan Henderson.
No, that would be Frankie Edgar.
Ah, that was an easy one. Of course,
I thought you would have got the Frankie Edgar one.
I'm sorry, man. It's been a while. It's been a while since we've seen it. You know, it's been what, 2 weeks? Like, God, that one pisses me off because I mean he has been the poster boy for unnecessary rematches. But actually, I do want to see those rematches. I mean, how many rematches has Edgar been a part of when you think of it? That pisses me off that I got those wrong. Although Randy Couture was the easy one. Still, with that being said, I think something we should talk about, Jason, they really don't need this division.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like I began the show off. If this was Chris Cyborg, I think there would be a lot more optimism. But, I think at the end of the day, it's – if Chris Cyborg, you know, and we'll see what happens with USADA, I think that the belief is she's going to get a 9 to 12 month suspension that'll be retroactive to December of last year. So, you know, we're probably not talking about seeing her till, you know, at the absolute earliest, you know, the last event of the year of 2017 or sometime early on in 2018. I just, you know, it's one of those things of I just feel like you're doing one off fights, and what's the point of having a title in division when essentially you're just doing one-off fights?
Here is the entire database from UFC.com of the women's featherweight division. You go to their roster page, you click on women's featherweight division, you get the whole roster, every like multiple pages. Here they are. You have Jermaine de Randamie, Holly Holm. Oh, and that's it. You have two fighters on their roster and they're fighting each other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it'll be interesting, you know, because, you know, this, you know, I know Misha Tate's been asked a couple times if this is going to get her out of retirement. It seems like, you know, that's not going to get her out of retirement. So it'll be interesting to kind of see what the UFC does here at 145 pounds. Also be very interesting to maybe see if maybe Chris Cyborg's in attendance on Saturday night. You know, the co-main event of this fight card, I think, is probably one of the more interesting matchups for me on this card. It's not the fight that I'm most interested in. I'll tell you that later on. It's actually one of the preliminary card fights that has me the most interested. But you know, this is a matchup for a fight that kind of came out of the blue a couple weeks ago, you know, and then all of a sudden it was a Friday afternoon. The UFC goes on Twitter and says, oh, by the way, the co-main event of UFC 208 is Anderson Silva versus Derek Brunson. And, you know, I don't know if this is the best matchup for Derek Brunson, because, you know, when I think of Derek Brunson, I think of a very aggressive striker, and the type of fight that I think doesn't really work out for him is a counter striker, and that's what Anderson Silva is. And, you know, yes, Anderson Silva, you know, the 2010-2011 Anderson Silva is not walking through the door. We both know that. But it is kind of crazy to think of the last time Anderson Silva won a fight was 2012.
That is crazy. That is believable yet sad, and makes me feel so stupid because I like Anderson in this fight, and I shouldn't. I absolutely should not. I'm going to hedge it with my prop bet, which is Brunson by KOTK. I'm not sure how hedging works, but I think if you put $100 down for Anderson Silva at plus 125 and $100 down for Brunson via KOTKO at 250, I think you win money either way. I'm not sure. I'm not a gambling expert. But that's what my strategy would be for this fight.
See, I'm vice versa. I would take Anderson Silva by TKO-KO plus 290. I think what happens here, you know, is Derek Brunson rushes in. We see kind of a little bit along the same type of fighting style he had against Robert Whittaker. And I think Anderson knocks him out with the counterpunch.
I mean, I could see that for sure. It's just that I could also see Anderson. Well, actually, I could. Man, this fight could get rough towards the third round, I think, actually.
Oh, I don't think this fight gets out of the first round.
Yeah. It's interesting here, man. It really is, because Derek Brunson looked like total butt in his last fight. I mean, total butt. Like, that's one of the worst performances we've seen out of a high-level fighter in a long time. I mean, let's not forget what happened there. Like, he put his – like, I don't know what he was doing. How would you describe his last fight against Whittaker? Like, what went on there?
Reckless. Completely reckless. I mean, yeah. I remember watching that fight going, like, Derek, man, you got to be more technical. Because, you know, and he's going to rush you. And who knows, maybe part of Anderson's thought process is, hey, I'm going to let this guy rush me. I'm going to wear him out, and then eventually I'm going to pull the trigger. I mean, you know, one of the things about Anderson Silva is, yes, he is 0-4 with one no contest in his last five fights. And, you know, and yes, he's not the same guy, you know, that was tearing up the middleweight division, you know, through his run there in that division. He's not the same guy. But, you know, when you think about what's going on here, I mean, you look at the two, you know, Weidman fights, obviously the first one, you know, you can't play around like that. Eventually, you know, something's going to happen. And of course, you know, the injury there in the rematch. And then of course he got that win over Nick Diaz, which was ultimately overturned to a no contest due to his failed post-fight drug test with Nevada State Athletic Commission. Then, you know, last year he comes back. Michael Bisping, I mean, you still go back to that third round when it all appears that, you know, he has knocked out Michael Bisping and the fight's over. And then ultimately Michael Bisping, you know, ultimately, you know, scores a 5-round decision. And then, you know, he steps up on, you know, what, 4 days notice, 5 days notice, whatever it was, maybe 3 days notice to take on Daniel Cormier at UFC 200, where, you know, I think everyone was rooting for Anderson Silva in that fight, but ultimately, you know, just, you know, Daniel Cormier used his wrestling and probably a fight that, you know, lost Daniel Cormier a lot of fans in that one too. So it's not like there's been this, you know, significant drop off in Anderson Silva's abilities. But for Derek Brunson, I mean, this is a guy that, yes, he's coming off a loss to Robert Whittaker, but he finds himself in pretty much even a bigger fight.
Yeah, this is kind of a perfect situation for Brunson given his last result, because, you know, I don't know, does Robert Whittaker have a fight booked? Because if he does, Brunson may have the bigger fight, actually. Let me Google that real quick. That would be kind of hilarious. Yeah, I'm not sure if does Whittaker have a fight booked?
I don't believe Whittaker has a fight. No, you know, I know a lot of people thought maybe the Musasi fight would have made sense, but now Musasi's, you know, taking on Chris Weidman. But I mean, Robert
Whittaker's one of the best. Reward?
Yeah, I mean, Whittaker's one of the best, you know, 185 pounders in the world. I mean, you know, I mean, this is a guy that drained himself so much to get to 170, you know, moves up to 185, and he's looked great there. You know, but it's a huge opportunity for Derek Brunson. I mean, you know, you look at Derek and the run that he has gone on in the UFC. You know, we all remember those two wins at Star with Chris Lieben and Brian Houston, and then he gets, you know, loses Yoel Romero, and then wins against Lorenz Larkin at Herman, Sam Alvey, Carnero, and Hall. I mean, you look at his losses in Strikeforce and the UFC, it's Jacare Souza, Yoel Romero, and Robert Whittaker. I mean, which you look at that and you say, okay, he's able to beat guys who are, you know, ranked below him, but every time that step up in competition happens, he can't take that next step.
And the interesting part is, Anderson Silva in 2017 is probably in that middle area between the guys Brunson's beaten and the guys he's lost to. He is kind of when you analyze and you say, all right, the best fighter Brunson's probably beaten in that run is either Uriah Hall or I guess Lorenz Larkin now at UFC 177. So Anderson, I think we could put him kind of in between those guys and Whitaker, Romero, and Jacare. So this is huge for Derek Brunson. This is a fight where there's a clear path to victory for him. It's with his wrestling. If he has a boring fight like Cormier, he can get the victory. There will be a lot of eyeballs on him, especially post-fight. After the fight, people are going to want to know the result, look up highlights and whatnot. And you're talking about a huge name of the sport who may or may not be past his prime. I like how you laid out the fact that really Silva had not laid an egg. He had not looked bad until the Cormier fight. I mean, he looked bad when his leg was snapped in half, but that was just an injury. That just was gruesome anyway. But the Cormier fight was rough, but granted, 3 or 4 days notice for Silva. So,
and let's be honest about it. Cormier probably had, what, 20 pounds on him?
20 pounds on him as well. I wouldn't be surprised if Brunson has a strength advantage just given the power he showcases time and again. So perfect opportunity for Derek Brunson. Again, I have the prop bet Brunson via KO, TKO. But my pick is Anderson Silva. I really want to ride with the champion one last time. I do get the sense there is a real looseness in his camp leading up to this one. Maybe this is what BJ Penn fans tell themselves every time he's made his comebacks about how this is the time he's going to refine the old glory and whatnot. But I really do think so. For Anderson, he's going to take advantage of an improper game plan from Derek Brunson. And he's going to get a victory, potentially in the first round, like you say, KO, TKO. I just, given the way Brunson fought last time, given how great Anderson Silva is, was, whatever, I like the Spider to finally get a win for the first time since 2012.
You know, and the thing that concerns you a little bit about Derek Brunson is this fighter has his own gym there in Wilmington, North Carolina, and he's the big fish. You know, he's not at, you know, I know he's done some training in the past at Jackson Wink, and it's a little concerning when, you know, you are that big fish and, you know, in terms of who he has around him. But, you know, we did get this question from Christian, which is on Twitter at WWE Big Show Fan 6, saying, is Anderson jumping Yoel Romero with a win? I truly believe so. It would not shock me, first off, but I think that Yoel Romero is doing a tremendous job of someone who, speaks a little English, but, he's learning to speak English. But I think he's done an incredible job of pretty much selling himself to make sure that this fight with Michael Bisping does happen. You know, he called in Michael Bisping's Sirius XM show on Thursday. And, but if you're Michael Bisping, though, if Anderson Silva goes out there and, you know, pulls off, you know, a devastating victory, if I am the manager of Michael Bisping, which is Adi Attar, I probably go, man, let's do the rematch with Anderson.
Yeah, you want the weaker opponent if you're Bisping's agent. Question is, if you're Bisping, do you want the more impressive opponent?
I think Romero destroys Bisping.
I know, but that's an embarrassing thing to admit if you're the quote-unquote champion. I think Romero would. I think the agent should put Silva in there. That would suck for people that like sports. I wouldn't be surprised if the fight happens if Silva wins. There is a long, long history of questionable title fights because we can market it better. Quote-unquote, you know, cough, cough, Dan Henderson. That Dan Henderson title shot should have never happened, really.
What are you talking about? He was so deserving.
I mean, look, that was a close fight.
It was, it was one of those fights that I think as, you know, and as, you know, two people who sit here and talk about MMA on a podcast, we're supposed to, you know, be neutral, whatnot. But there was part of you that as you're sitting there watching Dan Henderson, Michael Bisping, that I think all of us were rooting for Dan Henderson.
Oh, that would have been a movie, a straight up movie. But can you imagine if they pass up Romero here, Jason? We're talking an 8-fight win streak. That includes wins over Kennedy, Tim Kennedy, Lyoto Machida, Jacare, Weidman, and Derek Brunson. To pass him up would just be like pissing in the wind, I think.
You know, one of the things about Anderson Silva, and who knows how much longer Anderson Silva is going to fight. I don't get the sense that he's someone that necessarily wants to walk away, but who knows whenever you know, that may come. And as I always say, Father Time is undefeated. But, you know, we talk about iconic entrances in the UFC, and, you know, Uriah Faber, one of the most iconic ones with California Love, you know, is now retired. And, you know, there's always something about an Anderson Silva fight when Ain't No Sunshine by DMX comes on those speakers. It's just, it's an iconic walkout song.
You know, is any new fighter coming out with iconic walkout songs? I feel no.
I think if I was representing a fighter, I would say, hey, look at Uriah Faber, Anderson Silva, Vanderlei Silva. They, you know, when their songs come on, you know it's them walking out. I think I would, if I was a managing a UFC fighter, I would sit there and direct them, say, hey, pick a song and let's go with it and let's make this your brand.
What would your song be?
Oh, I don't know.
I would go with "Born This Way" by Lady Gaga.
Oh, you know, you hipster!
I want to, you know. And what I would do is I would just jump off the roof of the arena, like Sting or like Lady Gaga at my entrance. I mean, you know how dope that would be, dude. If you entered every fight by jumping, like free falling with a cable on your back. You would be the most – I mean, you would be really gassed by the time the fight started. But if you were a heavyweight, you know, give it 30 seconds, your opponent will be too. Yeah, I mean, totally. They're really – and maybe there is a guy who I can't think of that just – I mean, the last guy, new guy, and he's not new at all because he's a former champion. But the youngest guy I can think of that has an iconic entrance kind of is Chris Weidman.
Yeah, Weidman, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one with can't won't back down or whatever.
Yeah, by Tom Petty.
Yeah, I mean it's starting to lose his luster as he continues to lose, but I can't really think of anybody else. But yeah, there is a void, man. There is absolutely a void. That is one of the things that we don't really talk about, but definitely sticks out. Is there is a real factor of these legends just have badass entrances. I mean, BJ Penn's entrance was awesome.
Yeah,
you know that fight peaked when he was walking out to the cage. And there's a chance that this fight could peak with Anderson walking out of the cage, although if both of us are right, then that won't be the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's – and by the way, a buddy of mine told me if you're a Tom Petty fan, there's a really good documentary that's out on Netflix. I haven't checked it out yet, but definitely plan to check it out at some point if you're if you like Tom Petty. But yeah, I think Anderson wins this fight. I think it comes in the first round, and it really would not surprise me if Michael Bisping starts pushing for a rematch against Anderson Silva. But in terms of prop bets, I do like Anderson Silva by TKO KO, which is +290. You also, this main card also has a middleweight matchup, a very odd middleweight matchup between Jacare Souza and Tim Boach. People may remember it was, you know, right at, I think it was about 24 hours before this fight was put out. Jacare's manager went on Craigslist and put up an ad for someone who wants to fight Jacare Souza because, you know, everything you hear is that there isn't exactly people just, you know, jumping at you know, at the moment to sit there and fight Jacare Souza. But this is a fight that I personally just look at this matchup as more of a, you know, give Jacare another fight, you know, let him get a payday, you know, and Tim Boach is 2-0 since coming, you know, back to 185 pounds. And, you know, we always talk about path to victory for fighters in this fight. And for Tim Boach, it's simple. He's got to keep the fight on the feet. If this fight plays out in the feet, that is his only way to win this fight. This fight goes to the ground. Jacare submits him within 90 seconds of it going to the ground?
I would say 110. You know, give him another 20 seconds, all right? He may not be an Abu Dhabi champion, but Tim Boach, he knows his yeah, look, if this hits the ground, this will be quick. If this stays on the feet, this could be quick. Although Tim Boach is not the kind of guy you ever want to count out on the feet.
No.
He has made a career out of, holy moly, did he just do that? On the feet, and I could totally see that. I mean, I really can't see that happening, but I could totally see that happening. I could totally see just the most, what the F, did Tim Boach really just do that? This card is officially nutty. I tell you what, a lot of these fights on this main card, we're going to talk about the other one next, make no sense to me. This is one of them. Although, the only reason why I'm not complaining about it anymore is because Jacare's camp was so desperate for any fight, as you made the case there. So I'm like, okay, maybe he just wanted to get a fight in. But yeah, this one makes no sense. You got 3 versus 13, and it's not like 13 is your Joe Silva type rising prospect.
and Jacare, I believe this is actually the last fight on Boach's UFC deal, which also makes it kind of awkward.
Totally awkward, although maybe they feel incredibly confident in Jacare, and I don't see why not. I mean, he's minus 525 for a reason. Just real quick, I did not look at the odds. I don't have a prop bet here. I just wanted to look real quick at what Boach. Boach winning by KO, TKO is 853, which is, you know, it's a nice hedge.
If you want to just throw a dart at the board, you can throw that there. I mean, obviously, Jacare by submission would be the route you want to go, but the odds are absolutely awful on that. Jacare by TKO KO plus 390 is one that jumped out to me. I could maybe see, this fight goes to ground and ultimately, gets a TKO victory on the ground.
Yeah. I could see that just raining down strikes from the top position, maybe switching off from a submission to ground strikes. That's a real possibility. I mean, look, there's a clear gap in talent. Jacare is part of the middleweight elite. Tim Boach is not, but we have to mention Tim Boach has shown a history of these come from behind absurd wins, largely due to his great, great power. But Jacare is clearly the pick here.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, even though I did give the prop bet of Jacare by TKO KO, I think most likely you'll see Jacare get a submission win in the first round here, maybe second round. But, obviously a little bit of a showcase that fight there for Jacare Souza. And who knows what's going to happen with Jacare after his fight was over. I watched his interview with Ariel Helwani earlier this week from Brooklyn. Basically felt that Luke Rockhold really wasn't injured when he pulled out of their fight that was scheduled for Australia last year. So maybe that's a route that the UFC tries to go back down when Luke Rockhold is healthy to go. The next matchup is, I mean, you talk about head-scratcher matchups, and obviously Jacare Boach is a head-scratcher. Go to Jared Cannonier was also a head-scratcher. I remember when this fight got announced, I was like, is the UFC just screwing with us here? Is this really the route they're going? And it is the route they're going. I mean, Jared Cannonier is a guy that talked about going down to, came in the UFC as a heavyweight, drops down to 205, gets a win. After that win, he's like, hey, I might go down to 185, which he said this week that the doors to that are not closed, that maybe even he'll fight at both weight classes, 205 and 185. But this is about obviously an opportunity for him here. And this is kind of, I look at this fight very similar to Jacare and Boach. If for Jared Cannonier to have a chance here, this fight's got to stay on the feet. Once this fight hits the ground, it's going to share all day.
Yeah, Cannonier is a little better than I originally thought he was on the ground, actually, but that's still not to say that I think he's going to have any type of advantage if it hits there. I think he can more than make up for, really stalling Glover on the ground, maybe causing the referees to stand him up. But to me, his likelihood of victory is on the feet. I was a bit surprised to see the odds on this one. That's okay. So two things make me want to pick Jared independent of anything we've ever seen in the cage. The two things is that this fight was made. Anytime you see a fighter like Glover, ranked number 3, take on an unranked fighter, you begin to wonder if the UFC knows something you don't. And whenever you see odds where that unranked fighter is only plus 175 against a number 3 guy, you begin to really, really get excited about that upset. Because, the combination of the UFC and the odds makers kind of giving you some subtext here. The upset's going to happen here. This is changing the guard. I still can't pull the trigger here, man. I feel like you got more bank here with Teixeira, more history against high-level competition. At the end of the day, as much potential as Jared has shown in his career, his most impressive win is over Ian Kutalaba. So Teixeira's the pick. This fight really makes no sense. I'm excited to see how Jared looks against Glover.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Glover is how does he bounce back after getting knocked out in 13 seconds by Rumble Johnson back at UFC 202. And, you do forget that prior to that, submission win against OSP, and then, TKO victory of Patrick Cummings, and then knockout victory over Rashad Evans. So how does he bounce back? I'm interested to kind of see that. But I do like the prop head of Glover to share by TKO or KO at plus 277, but would not be surprised if he ultimately wins by submission here. But look, if Jared Cannonier can somehow pull off a victory here, you know, we always talk about the UFC needs to find that next line of challengers at 205 pounds. Jared Cannonier could be that guy.
Oh, he could. I mean, any guy who starts off unranked and picks off your top one of your top five fighters in any division immediately becomes a guy that you should put so many resources in outside of the cage. I mean, if he's able to just look competitive against Glover, you gotta like the lack of times he's been in the cage in terms of like this is a new face. So if he looks competitive against Glover, even with the loss, Jason, the UFC needs to really invest in getting people to know about Jared's personality.
Well, also, the UFC needs to start having it to where guys who are fighting on pay-per-view aren't talking about how they have a full-time job and they're fighting the number three guy in the world.
You're telling me that's bad optics?
Yeah. Jared Cannonier has a full-time job, and you know, and he was asked about it this week, and he said, he goes, look, I can't be a full-time fighter financially at this point. I have to have a full-time job. Now, sometimes the reason some guys may say they have a full-time job is more about because, hey, you know, they want the health benefits that come along with that job. But if you're the UFC, I mean, that's got to be something that you just hope that narrative can go away, because it is a bad look.
Yeah, they should start paying fighters more. I think that would help out. That's crazy. That's sad. Can you imagine if, you know, how many times have people had the conversation where, can you imagine if Chris Paul had to work 9 to 5 at Carl's Jr.? You know, like, that's kind of crazy.
I'll tell you this right now. If I had a son, I'd be teaching him how to play basketball. Guaranteed contracts, and those contracts are going through the roof.
You don't understand. No. If I had a son, I'd be teaching him how to be a commissioner.
or a left-handed starting pitcher.
Or left-handed starting pitch, that one too. Although, no, basketball's the smart pick, dude. Everyone's watching basketball. I think I'm the youngest person that watches baseball right now. So
it's funny. Is I was having a conversation the other day, and we were talking about baseball, and you know, because one of the things coming out is they're trying to find ways to how do you shorten games and this what they're going to experiment in minor league baseball with if the game goes to extra innings, you know, that there's a runner who starts on second base, which, let's be honest, by that means one hit and the run's going to score for the most part. You know, baseball, it's you have to, you know, and honestly, the reason I watch baseball more than anything else is fantasy baseball. If I wasn't in a fantasy baseball league, I would not watch as much baseball as I do.
Look, this is one thing that pisses me off. This whole, if we shorten baseball, people are going to watch it. Yeah, if you shorten it to 30 minutes, people are going to watch it. You know how drastic the difference in time would have to be for like a shortened baseball to affect the ratings? It would have to be so drastic you ruin the sport. So if you don't take a half measure, that extra inning thing is stupid. One of the most amazing things about baseball is literally like, anything can happen every single game. Once you eliminate that possibility, you really ruin that. But,
well, I mean, the problem baseball has is, and you can see it in television viewership, it's an old demo.
Yeah, that's why. You
don't have that. I mean, the you know, like what the UFC is going after, what the NFL, the NBA, they're going after that male 18 to 49 audience. That is the key demo. And when you see, I believe last year, I remember at one point I saw the average age for MLB was, I believe, 54 years old.
Oh, that's crazy. That's believable.
I mean, it's nuts. I mean, it's like I laugh at everyone's like, oh, baseball is America's game. And I go, what are you smoking?
No,
I go, football is America's game.
Yeah, football is, and then basketball is a second right now.
I think in basketball, it depends where you're at. Because I can tell you, I mean, I love basketball, but where I live here in Tampa, Florida, basketball's not huge.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was in sports radio, you know, people would say, oh, you know, you should talk basketball. And I go, yeah, you talk basketball, you may get one phone call over 4 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's believable. That is believable because, I mean, what's your favorite Tampa Bay basketball moment? There ain't many.
No, I mean, there was, they tried to, there was like a minor league team, but it was a league that was trying to form it, and Tampa was going to be one of the teams. But, you know, there was at one point, there was, you know, when Bill Davidson owned the Lightning, who owned the Detroit Pistons, there was talk of maybe he might try to move the Pistons to Tampa, you know, because they were, you know, it was a point where they're trying to get a new building there up in Detroit. And then before the Magic got their building built in Orlando, there was some talk of maybe, you know, the Magic moving to the Amalie Arena in Tampa. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's awful to watch Orlando Magic basketball. It's very tough to be an Orlando Magic fan. It's very tough.
Yeah, I bet. I think there's going to be quite a few new people in that building next year in terms of management. I will say the reason
I'm just saying, Dwayne Bacon, baby. Let's just bring him in.
Just bring in the entire Florida State team. They're probably better than Orlando. But I think the reason why basketball is, you know, well, the reason – well, baseball needs to learn from basketball. And 51 minutes into this podcast, I'm gonna fix baseball. Ready? This is what you need to do, Jason. You need to make stars and get people to care about wins and losses. Mm-hmm. Get people to identify with one of the 30 teams so they feel like they need to turn on TV to figure out what happens. And you need to get people to recognize stars, because how many people do you know in your life you think would recognize Mike Trout in the street, the Ooh. Best player in baseball?
Outside of Los Angeles?
Outside of Los Angeles, in Florida, no one would.
No, I mean, in his hometown, people would, which I believe is up in New Jersey. But yeah, it's. I mean, hell, even where I live in Tampa, you know, I live in the section called South Tampa, which is where a lot of the athletes, you know, pretty much in Tampa, the athletes either live in South Tampa or they live up in the Tampa Palms area. But I mean, if I went out and you put a, you know, if you walked in with five Tampa Bay Rays players. I mean, unless it's Evan Longoria, I don't know how many people would recognize him.
Oh, yeah. And that's the biggest
problem. I guess people would probably recognize Chris Archer, but that's more based on his hair.
Yeah, there are more UFC fighters that would be recognized than baseball players.
Oh, I've been in situations where you see a UFC fighter somewhere out and about, and no one knows who they are.
Well, no, it depends what kind of fighter. I mean,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, obviously it does.
Yeah, like I would say there's just more star fighters that would be recognized than baseball players. Like, I think Connor for sure gets recognized anywhere and everywhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Connor is a different animal, you know? That's totally different.
That is true. That is true. He's a...
I mean, let's be honest, but how many UFC fighters is TMZ stopping besides Connor and Ronda and Dana White? You know, they're not stopping anybody else.
No. I mean, they only do Connor, and they just do... I mean, they'll probably stop maybe Paige VanZant. But no one else I can really think of. I mean,
So you're saying they wouldn't stop Dustin Poirier and Jim Miller?
Oh, phenomenal transition. And this is a fight that's going to have so many transitions between Miller and Poirier on the ground.
I feel this is Poirier's fight to lose.
Oh, yeah. He's certainly the favorite, and Jim Miller's certainly that scrappy dog that, like, smells blood, and he's ready to pull off an upset.
I think that my question with Dustin Poirier, and he's kind of talked about this, is where kind of the emotional side of fighting kind of gets to him. And when that does get to him, he tends to lose. I mean, I think that I like Dustin Poirier's abilities all around more than Jim Miller. But I think this is a sneaky fight of the night pick.
Yeah, I love that so much, because Jim Miller's career has been predicated on being a part of the best fight of the night. If he wins here, this would be the first time he wins four in a row since freaking 2009, 2010. I mean, this would be quite a turnaround for Jim Miller for him to win here. I don't think he does, Jason. Dustin Poirier's upside to me is significantly higher than Jim Miller's, but there's a higher floor for Miller. That's where you feel good about maybe Poirier emotionally having issues. In terms of executing his game plan, I think this is going to be a great fight, but I like Poirier to win this one. Who's your pick?
I got Poirier by decision.
Yeah, but you could.
I think it's a fun back and forth fight. I think you'll see some good scrambles on the ground, but ultimately, I think that Dustin gets the decision victory.
Yeah, I could dig that.
In terms of preliminary card, and I noted a little earlier that the fight that has me most interested on this fight card is on the preliminary card, and I guess just call me MMA hipster. Ian McCall, Jared Brooks at 125 pounds.
Ian McCall looks like a hipster, and you are a hipster. No, I'm kidding. That's a good fight, man. But why are you excited? Is it because Ian McCall is finally, for the love of goodness, fighting?
That is definitely part of it. And Jared Brooks, who took this fight on short notice when Neil Seary pulled out of the fight due to a family situation, is Jared Brooks has gone all in on social media. And there was a post he had the other day where he said it was a meme he put up. You know, you go on this website, you create your own meme, and it was a picture of Ian McCall. And he said that, basically saying that I'm going to send you to Bellator.
That guy has no chill. Jared Brooks. I love it. That is dope. I mean, that's not getting out traction, but that would be cool if the UFC did a better job of putting a microscope on that type of trash talk.
Oh, I mean, and the two of them have been going back and forth. And, you know, it is the first time that we've seen Ian McCall in 2 years, of course, you know, various reasons, injuries, you know, weight issues with, you know, with his opponents. But ultimately this does happen. And when I look at this preliminary card at UFC 208, I truly feel that the next title challenger at 125 pounds is going to come out of the preliminary card. That it's people may think I'm crazy, but I think if Ian McCall goes out there and has a dominating stoppage victory, it would not surprise me one bit if the UFC offers him a title fight against Demetrius Johnson. But also, I think you have to look at Wilson Hayes. If he goes out there and has a dominating victory over Sasaki, of course, we all remember Wilson was supposed to fight Demetrius back at UFC 201. I really feel that. I think the narrative of this preliminary card is that that Demetrius Johnson's next title challenger, we're going to find out on Saturday night.
Yeah, that brings me to my fight that I'm looking forward to, Wilson Hayes and Sasaki. And that's largely due to the fact that Wilson Hayes is in that fight. I mean, you mentioned it at UFC 201. He was supposed to fight DJ. Now, there's a reason why it was him. Largely, I believe that was due to guys pulling out, right? That's why that fight was made.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't like he was the clear-cut number one contender. He beat Hector Sandoval. Anyways, I'm excited to see Wilson fight. I know he's motivated. I'm sure if he wins in impressive fashion, he'll do a call-out. That's one of my prop bets, too. Hayes winning by submission, I have at plus 135. It's not a lot. Maybe like you should that. Also, yeah, maybe also go with wins by KO, TKO at plus 350 and put money down on both of them so you can win either way. And then once he wins by decision, you can feel like crap. Yeah, I love this fight largely due to Wilson Hayes. I think Sasaki will keep it interesting. But to me, Jason, you're breaking down the prelims and you're asking yourself, what is the most interesting? You got to point to the two flyweight bouts. And then you have to ask yourself, why is the welterweight fight between Randy Brown and Bilal Muhammad the quote-unquote Fox Sports 1 main event?
That is an odd one to me. When the fight card lineup came out and that was there, and then that Marcin Tybura versus Justin Willis was your feature put on UFC Fight Pass, a little bit odd situation there. To me, I would have put Ian McCall, Jared Brooks as the headliner on FS1. And look, Jared Brooks was a guy that, you know, he's 11-0 in his career. This guy was going to get to the UFC. You know, whether it happened on short notice, opportunity or not, the kid's legit. I do wonder if maybe that moment that those UFC jitters are going to get to him. Of course, you know, you got to wonder about Ian McCall. You know, I've done a couple of interviews with Ian over the past couple of months, and you know, I think bad luck is probably one way you would describe what is going on with Ian McCall. But, you know, Ian basically said, he goes, look, it'd be easy to walk away, but I love this. I love being a fighter. So I'm going to keep battling here. And, you know, he said to me, he believes it's going to take 3 wins for him to get a title fight. I don't think it's going to take that long because, you know, when you talk about rematches and Demetrius Johnson, I think that, you know, Tim Elliott would be a rematch. I think people would be up for. I think Ian McCall is the other one. You know, I mean, you know, Ian had some good fights with Demetrius. You know, it would be their third matchup. I think it's a fight you can definitely go down there. You know, in terms of prop bets, you know, Ian McCall to win inside the distance at plus 415 is one I like there. You know, Bilal Muhammad, you know, it's a huge prop bet here for him to win by TKO or KO, which is plus 870. The only premise which I think that could be an issue for that to happen is, you know, Randy Brown's got a huge reach advantage on him. He's going to have to get on the inside. Bilal's a guy that more tries to fight at range. So if he can get on the inside of Randy Brown, I think he gets a win. I do like Bilal Muhammad to win that fight. Just like you, I like Wilson Hines to win by submission. Ian McCall, I think that he gets a finish late in this fight, likely in the third round. And then the other matchup on the TV prelims, and this could be, you know, look, if you do not like ground fighting, you're probably not going to like Nick Lentz versus Islam Makhachev. There could be a lot of, if you like the ground game, I think this is a fight that you're probably going to dig. I think there's going to be some interesting scrambles on the ground. I like Islam Makhachev, and Daniel, just call me crazy, I like the under 2.5 rounds prop on this fight, which is at plus 240.
You're crazy. Why do you like under 2.5 rounds?
I think Makhachev gets a stoppage in the second round.
I thought you were going to say because, like, in the second round.
No, I think that the first round will be a fun fight. You know, we should be noted as we're recording this podcast, the weigh-ins are going down, and I saw one of the reporters mention that Nick Lentz did look bad on the scale. He did make weight. As I'm recording this podcast right now, everyone has made weight. Only two fighters left to go in terms of stepping on the scale. So I just think Makhachev gets a stoppage late in the second round.
I thought you were going to say in the second round, Donald Trump is going to show up, and with the Islam Makhachev name makes him really uncomfortable. I thought that was your game plan, Jason, but apparently not. Apparently not. No, look, I think that's interesting because Nick Lentz, what he needs to do, he needs to change his perception, Jason, because it's 2017. And I'm tired of Nick Lentz being quote-unquote boring fighter. I think he needs to go out there and be exciting, cut awesome promos. I know he's capable of it. So I want to see a finish here too. I don't think it's going to happen though, but I think Makhachev wins. I think Nick Lentz is hard to put away. He really is. But I like you zagging when most people zig. I could see that happening. And basically all the other prelims I agree with. Although I've gone back and forth on Brown and Muhammad. But at the end of the day, you got to ask yourself, Jason, was this guy on the UFC looking for a fight? And if he was, you pick the other guy. So,
yeah,
Bilal Muhammad.
I just think Muhammad's just overall a better fighter.
But
he does. I mean, look, you know, Brown's, you know, has got that a huge reach advantage. He has a huge reach for 170. So see there. When it comes to the fight pass prelims, you got mentioned Tiber and Willis. Willis making his UFC debut on short notice. He trains out of AKA. Some people may remember him. He had a fight in the World Series of Fighting. You also got Ryan LaFlair against Rowan Carnero, and Rick Glenn versus Felipe Inover. I like Rick Glenn. Ryan LaFlair. When it comes to heavyweight matchup, man, I don't feel good picking either guy, but I would probably go Marcin Tybura.
Yeah. I was like, man, you know what? I can talk myself into Justin Willis. And I like looked up some of his pictures. I'm like, okay, Marcin Tybura, I like him because he doesn't have a pot belly. Tybura's my pick here, and he's my prop bet pick too, Jason. TKO at plus 150. I like that, largely due to the fact that while Justin Willis, you love where he trains, AKA, you love the idea of his potential. I think for Tybura, you got a fighter who understands how important it is for him to win here. He has experience. He showcased striking power, and he gets the win here. And I like KO, TKO as the prop bet.
I do like one prop bet on the preliminary card. That's Rick Glenn by TKO KO plus 360. Okay. You know, Rick had a very fun, exciting fight in his UFC debut against Evan Dunham, now back at his natural weight class of 145 pounds. Took that fight against Dunham, just basically told me, he said, hey, UFC comes calling, you gotta take that fight. So back at 145, and you have to imagine that a loss by Felipe Inover probably means his days in the UFC are done.
Yeah, unless with a loss, that puts him in position to get a rematch with Henan Barao. I don't know what you do if you're the UFC with the next Anderson Silva. No, I like the pick there for your prop bet just because I do think that Felipe Inover is slightly overrated, and that's saying a lot given that, you know, he's the first on the prelims. I think we may have overvalued him, and I like the pick there. And I do think with the loss, it's probably all it for him. I also agree. I like LaFlair to beat Carnero, although Carnero's ground game, you can't discount that.
And let's just wrap here by going with our predictions. I'm going to go Jermaine Day or Maname by split decision. Yeah, I'm going to go out on the limb. Split decision there. Anderson Silva by knockout in the first round. Jacare Souza. I'm going to say it ultimately comes in the second round with a submission. Glover Teixeira, a second round submission over Jared Cannonier. Ike Dustin Poirier by decision. I'm going to go Bilal Muhammad by decision. Wilson Hayes by submission. I'm going to go Islam Makhachev by TKO in the second round. I'm going to go Ian McCall by TKO in the third round. And then I'll go Marcin Tybura by knockout in the first round. Ryan LaFleur by decision. And Rick Glenn by TKO in the third round.
Yeah, I'll copy you with Glenn. I'll go TKO. I don't know about the third round. But I'll go all three rounds. One of those three. Oh, safe. LaFleur decision. Tybura KO TKO. McCall decision, Makhachev decision, Wilson Hayes submission, Bilal Muhammad to win via decision. Same for Poirier and Glover Teixeira. And then you got Jacare via submission, Anderson Silva via knockout TKO, and lastly in the main event, Holly Holm via unanimous decision.
And, of course, all this is going to go down on Saturday night inside the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York, UFC 208. Fight card will begin with the preliminary card on UFC Fight Pass at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 3:30 on the West Coast. And then your TV prelims will begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on FS1, and your main card on pay-per-view, 10 p.m. in the East, 7 on the West. We'll be back after this fight card is over to recap everything that happened at UFC 208. And, of course, you can always listen to the show on RadioInfluence.com, iTunes, and Stitcher. Of course, also be sure to check out our sponsor, Fight TV. They have a bunch of internet pay-per-views that we offer there, so definitely check out our friends over there at Fight TV.
Here is Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera with an Inside the Dugout Quick Fix.
I worked in Montreal in 1992 as a bench coach for Felipe Alou. And Montreal was really good then. Of course, in 1994, the strike year, they had the best record in baseball. And, of course, the strike killed Montreal baseball there because they couldn't re-sign their players like Pedro Martinez and John Wetland and Larry Walker, and I can go on and on and on. They ended up trading, you know, those guys. You knowing Stuart Sternberg of the Tampa Bay Rays and knowing that they're looking for a new ballpark and the mayor and the situation in St. Petersburg.
Right.
But do you see baseball ever coming back to Montreal? There's been a push for it.
Part of it is that to move to Montreal for big league baseball, I'm not sure how it would work, because would you get a share of the national television contract if you're a Canada, because it's a different broadcasting system? That's number one. The money is about the same, because the biggest problem they used to have was the Canadian dollar wasn't as strong as the American dollar, so they could never be even. But now the currency is just about the same. The biggest thing that I look at is that everything there is government subsidized, so you'll have to go through the government to get them to build you a stadium and subsidize it. And there was a lot of red tape.
For sure.
To bring it back over there. But there's an appetite, I think, on both sides to see baseball. I'm not sure the Rays are exactly the ones, but I think they have to establish themselves with minor league baseball first to show everybody and prove that they'll support baseball once they come back, because it's a rich history. The other part is that there's no natural place to put baseball. So where you had the Olympic Stadium, that's too far out. As you look at the landscape of Montreal, it's a big mountain, and the city is built next to it. The Alouettes played out at the Olympic Stadium, and they ended up moving to Concordia University downtown because they're on the metro system, and their attendance went up, I think, like 300-400%.
Yeah.
So you have to bring them downtown in order to get them, much like the Padres. Bring them downtown, and people will come.
Inside the Dugout with Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.